This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, campus and community groups mobilize in support of a crusading Black educator in Philadelphia. And Black right-winger Armstrong Williams has little use for affirmative action, except when it comes to keeping his own two television stations. But first, Black public intellectual Cornel West brought down the house at Newark, New Jersey's Bethany Baptist Church. The church's pastor is Reverend William Howard, the former president of the National Council of Churches. And the talk was sponsored by POP, the People's Organization for Progress. POP President Larry Hamm laid out the background for the discussion. Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress. Dr. Cornel West began by talking about the challenge of organizing the struggle for liberation.
My organization would mean three things. We're talking about your vision and the courage behind your vision, your analysis. Do you really understand what you're up against? Do you understand the economy, the nation state, its relation to corporate media, and the reason why there's so much sleepwalking in the country? And then the organizing and mobilizing that has to take place. Yeah, we're going to talk about all of that tonight. I was blessed to write a song with a genius named Bootsy Collins. And we wrote a song called Freedom, F-R-E-E-D-U-M. When love is a threat of what happens to a people who have been taught to hate themselves, so unloved and uncared for, especially young folk. And when they encounter love, the first response is one of fear. It constitutes a threat because they're not used to being loved like that. Oh, yes. And you see, look at the history of Black people. It's the history of that caravan of love trying to get folk to wake up from their sleepwalking because they've been normalizing the thinking that love is so isolated and so rare and so atypical. That's why when Huey Newton stood in front of the police, they put the gun to his head and said, "You can kill me, I'm willing to die for the people." Black folks said, "This Negro's crazy." Never been loved like that, the way Nat Turner and Harriet Tubman and the way Sojourner Truth, the way Marcus Garvey, the way Malcolm X, the way Fannie Lou Hamer, the way Stokely Carmichael, the way Diane Rook, and the way Donny Hathaway, and the way Curtis Mayfield, and the way Shirley Caesar and James Cleveland love a people taught to hate themselves. Well, I want to begin by invoking one of the great figures in the caravan of love, the love train that the OJs sang about. And it is W. Du Bois. Anytime we raise those kind of crucial questions, you got to invoke the Sankofa bears. Oh, you got to look back to be in contact with the best of those who came before to empower you to move forward, which means you have to have a sense of history. You affirm the three dimensions of time, the past, the present, and the future. Du Bois was 89 years old when he put pen to paper and wrote these words. He had already been put before the U.S. court. They had him in handcuffs just 5 years earlier because he was trying to eliminate nuclear weapons around the world, because he was engaging in critiques of the American empire, and most importantly, because he was making connections between the vicious legacy of white supremacy and the inability of capitalism to deal with the problems of poor people. That's Du Bois. What does he have to say? 89 years old. He said, I want to write a trilogy. I want to write three novels. Can you imagine that? 89 years old. Next project, three novels. You turn to page 275 in that first novel, The Ordeal of Mansart. He said, there's four questions I've been wrestling with all of my life directly connected to the issue of organization and resistance and the struggle for liberation of a precious and priceless chocolate people, black people, African people in the new world. Du Bois said, the first question is, how does integrity face oppression? How does integrity face oppression? Second query. What does honesty do in the face of deception? Honesty in the face of deception. The third query, what does decency do in the face of insult? And that last query, how does virtue meet brute force? Those are the four queries I've been wrestling with. And he's saying in part, there will never, ever be an awakening among a sleepwalking people until the issues of what it means to have integrity and honesty and decency and virtue are thoroughly not just affirmed, but are enacted and embodied. These days, it's hard to find folk with integrity. We live in a context where everybody's up for sale. And everything is up for sale. You can call it commodification, marketization, commercialization. Too many churches believe the kingdom of God is a brand. So the blood at the cross becomes Kool-Aid, that thin stuff that can't sustain you. So you end up with churches that are mega churches but no mega courage. Oh, true. True. You end up with churches whose building fund is breaking every record, but their prison ministry is hardly working on the ground. Thank God for Bethany Baptist. But the blood is still flowing. Instead of integrity, you get cupidity. Love of money. Wu-Tang Clan said, cream. Cash rules. Cash rules, but it didn't have to rule me. What we love about those who constitute Win That Are Back is that they had an absolute commitment to integrity that would hold cupidity at arm's length. Yes, we all need money. Yes, we need cash flow. But when that money and that cash flow begins to determine what you're saying, what you're doing, who you are, that's a form of idolatry. No people can survive, especially a black people can survive, by succumbing to cupidity. And we got too many leaders, politically, economically, religious, intellectually, who are just selling their souls for a mess of pottage. Because they're so obsessed with some fleeting visibility. As if that's what the people are going to talk about at their funeral, as opposed to what kind of human beings they are, and what kind of witness did they bear, and what kind of service did they render. You got to be old school, in part, because it has a historical backdrop. And our market economy eliminates the history and the past, so that the very notion of there being a vision connected to integrity beyond just money, money, money is hard to conceive of. You can't have organization, my brother, without that deep sense of history, that connection, that bond, that source of empowerment. But we living in a moment in which cupidity and venality, and venality simply means I'm a candidate for bribery. Try me. And I'm not just talking about all the scandals in business and politicians and so forth. Obsession with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. That's what we're dealing with across the board. Why? Because the corruption is so ubiquitous. And it's hard to hold it at arm's length, let alone to follow the Negro National Anthem, which is to say what? Not lift every echo, but lift every voice. How many real voices do we have left in the country? How many echoes? Turn on your television and see. Fox News, right-wing propaganda. MSNBC, neoliberal propaganda. Where are the voices? It's like looking for Donny Hathaway and getting Milli Vanilli. Don't tell me what you're imitating. What are you creating? I don't want to see copies. I want to see originals. Where are the originals? Brother James, so good to see you. We're just at Broadway. Part of our course. I'm blessed to teach a course at Rahway on Fridays, every third Friday, 150 brothers in philosophy. Oh, we have a good time. We were just there this past Friday, wrestling with Lorraine Hansberry, Plato, and so forth. You right there wrestling with it, too. It's so good to see you, Brother James. And all those brothers, they understand the need for voices, because too many of them followed echoes and hit up against the dead end. And too many of them got caught for soft drugs and ended up in jail. Whereas those Wall Street executives who embezzled billions of dollars of insider trading, market manipulation, fraudulent activity, they sipping tea in the Congress, White House, and in the nightclub. We just had a brother Diamond the other day at Howard. I was blessed to preach at Howard on Sunday. And he was at Howard just right before me, giving this big degree, saying he expressed the core values of Howard University. I said, which Howard University are you talking about? You talking about Sterling Brown? Are you talking about Toni Morrison? Are you talking about Stokely Carmichael? Which Howard are you talking about? I love Howard University. I love Negro institutions. I love Negroes, I think. And that's very important, because too many of our leaders and spokesfolk love everybody but black people. Black folk just an afterthought. Oh, yeah, you're there, aren't you? No, you start on the chocolate side of town. Not because you're tribalistic or exclusivistic, but because your mom and daddy is chocolate. And your grandmother's chocolate. And if you don't learn to love them right, then you ain't gonna love nobody right. Even your love of the vanilla brothers and sisters. Vanilla brothers and sisters deserve all the love, yes, but your love of them will just be imitation and manipulation. Won't have any authenticity whatsoever if you ain't loving your own folk first. You don't need to apologize for that. You wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for that black love. How come black love is still viewed as somehow some tertiary phenomenon? One reason why Nelson Mandela was so loved, Martin Luther King Jr. so celebrated. You look at the news, you think the reason why they went to jail is because they were forgiving white brothers and sisters. No, they went there because they loved black people. and the love for black people spilled over to forgiveness to vanilla brothers and sisters. But the vanilla brothers and sisters were not center stage. Martin Luther King Jr., they put him in a paddy wagon in October 1960. Didn't tell him where they were going. Put a German shepherd in there, just him and a German shepherd in pitch dark for 5 hours. Brother Andy Young told me when Martin got out, it was just he and Daddy King waiting there at Reedville Prison in Tatnall County in Gutsbucket, Jim Crow, Georgia. Looked like Martin had a nervous breakdown. He only had one sentence in his mouth. This is the cross we must bear for the freedom of our people. That's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. That's real. That's authentic. Doesn't make him a god or a deity. The brother had been loved in such a way that he understood that he can love by somehow being part of that caravan of love. And therefore, he was willing to organize, clarify his vision, sharpen his analysis, and most importantly, to pay a price, not a market price, a moral, a spiritual, a political price. That's why June 26, 1964, he called Malcolm X. We know because it's on the FBI file. You look at Claiborne Carson's books, Malcolm X, FBI file. Martin Luther King, FBI file. June 26, 1964, Martin called Malcolm. March the 12th, Malcolm broke from the Nation of Islam. No Malcolm without the love of Elijah Muhammad. But out of love and critique, he has to break. March the 26th, they're shaking hands in front of the Capitol. June 21, three of our courageous freedom fighters in the South were killed. It was Sherman and Cheney and Goodman. And Malcolm had announced, we're going to the United Nations. We're going to put the United States on trial for the violation of human rights of black people. I invite all organizations to join me. Martin Luther King Jr. calls. What kind of history would we have had if they had got together? We need to talk about that moment. 3 days later, they tried to poison the food in Malcolm's plate. He's on to Africa. They never got a chance to hook up. But don't ever think that when you're talking about folk who fall in love with a people, I didn't say an abstraction, I didn't say even some kind of ideal, I'm talking about with a people. You fall in love with a people, you hate the fact they're being treated unjustly, you loathe the fact they're being treated unfairly, and if you don't do something, the rocks are going to cry out. That's what we're talking about when you're talking about organization among a people who have been downtrodden for so long, sleepwalking for so long, but hungry and thirsty for something more, but it's not available in the mainstream media. It's not available in the corporate media. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a little note. Exactly 46 years ago, it was a day and a half before he was shot in Memphis. He said, I want to preach Ebenezer on Sunday. He never got a chance to preach that sermon. The name of that sermon was Why America May Go to Hell. That's not Jeremiah Wright. Oh, that's not our dear brother Jeremiah Wright. That's Martin Luther King Jr. He didn't say America ought to go to hell. He didn't say America should go to hell. He said America may go to hell. Why? Because he had said America is a major conveyor of violence in the world. The major violator of international law in the world. He said, and I know the FBI has already said that I am the most dangerous man in America. That's a lie. I'm not the most dangerous man. The most dangerous force is the awakening of the people. The most dangerous force is when vision, analysis, and organization among a hated people, when a rage is transformed into a righteous indignation, almost like Jesus in the temple running out the money changers in Jerusalem. And that temple, of course, was the equivalent of White House, Congress, Wall Street, and Hollywood. Oh, that's the kind of Jesus we're talking about. Oh, yes. Out of what? Love for the least of these. The poor, the prisoner, the elderly, the fatherless, the motherless, the children, working people, all folk who've been spit on, all folk who've been devalued. Yes, that kind of fire. So fundamental for any kind of organizational renaissance. Now, I do hope we get not just 1,000, but 2,000 folk to join people, organization for progress. Oh, yes. Ain't no doubt about that. You need numbers. You need resources. But in the end, it's not just about numbers. You got to have the right kind of folk in there. If they're not on fire and they're lukewarm, it doesn't make any difference what your quantity is. It's still a low drag. You got to have folk who are willing to move, committed, full of convictions. But most importantly, you have to have folk who have a commitment to honesty. And that's the second theme that the great Du Bois was talking about. We live in an age of monstrous mendacity. Lies everywhere. Everywhere. And hyper-hypocrisy. And I'm talking also about ourselves. I'm not talking about just pointing fingers. All of us are cracked vessels now. We're walking contradictions. But we ought to be honest about it. We ought to be candid about it. I can't get over all this talk with Ukraine and Crimea and so forth. America acting like we've got such moral authority of a nation violating international law. Please, please, get off your symbolic crack pipe and tell the truth about yourself. Invading, occupy Iraq, a million people dead, violation of international law. Invade, occupy Afghanistan, violation of international law. What about Grenada? What about Panama? We can go on and on and on. What about Saudi Arabia and Bahrain? Come on, America. Do you think that we sleepwalking forever? Yes, we're concerned in international law, but let's start at home. Don't be so hypocritical. My God. 40% black, brown, and red children living in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That's morally obscene and spiritually profane. 20% of all of America's children living in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. Thank God for Pop. We see the moral outrage and righteous indignation and holy anger. Where else do you see it? Thank God for Philip Harper and the Dream Defenders, younger generation, hungry and thirsty for more than just that superficial stuff. Young folk are tired of being told, we want you to be highly successful so you can have material toys and be well adjusted to injustice. You think it. You think Ella Baker lived her life of such integrity and honesty so that she could produce just some successful Negroes? No, she wanted folk to use their success to be faithful to something bigger than them. Don't just be smart. Let the phones be smart. Be wise and courageous and compassionate. Thank God for the Dream Defenders. They say, yes, we want to be part of that tradition. We don't want to just be successful. And that's what it is in the age of Obama. Everybody wants to look up and see who are the successful black folk rather than look down and see who's stuck in the basement. Don't tell me about the glass ceiling that you're breaking unless you break in some convention in order to bear witness to a truth and some organizing that will have impact on the least of these. End up with a whole generation of peacocks. Look at me. Look at me. I'm so successful. I'm somebody. I'm so smart. I'm so articulate. I'm so eloquent. You can hear Muddy Waters of Mississippi saying, "Peacock strut because they can't fly." No, we come from a tradition of eagles who fly high and look low and lift as we climb, because whatever success and spiritual and intellectual weaponry we have, we render it to something bigger than us. It's the kingdom of God if you're a Christian like me. If Jesus is the best thing that ever happened to you, then you're already on the love train like me. But everybody don't have to be a Christian. Could be Muslims like Malcolm. Could be agnostics like James Baldwin. Could be a whole host of other kind of folk. We Christians have no monopoly on integrity and honesty, given the history of Christianity and its complicity with structures of domination and hatred against our Jewish brothers and sisters, or against our Muslim or Arab brothers and sisters. But there's some prophetic Christian folk who hold on and hold out. But it's telling those truths. 1% of the population own 42% of the wealth and counting. 1% of the population got 95% of all the income growth in the last 4 years. That's a Keith Sweat moment. Something just ain't right. It is. It's sick. It's pathological. It's a form of spiritual malnutrition and moral constipation. But some of those folk at the top, they know what's right, but the greed is just blocking the flow. And who suffers? The precious weak and vulnerable, disproportionately black, brown, and red. The justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. We're going to connect the structural and the institutional and the organizing with that militant tenderness that you hear in the voice of a David Ruffin or a Wanda Hutchison of the emotions. But a radical gentleness that you hear in a William Hart of the Delphonics or a Donald McPherson of the main ingredient. He the one before Cuba. Tenderness, gentleness, sweetness. That's part of the caravan of love that goes into connecting unarmed truth and unconditional love, even at it is part of a political militancy. Because when you confront a system that either buys off your leaders, murders your leaders, lies on your leaders, or kills them, the freest persons are always those who have an absolute commitment to integrity and decency and are willing to go under. That's the major fundamental challenge. And in the last 30 years with this class war from above, oligarchs and plutocrats, Wall Street banks and corporate elites, war against working people, war against trade union movement, war against wages, profits going up, wages stagnating, masses of wealth transferred from poor and working people to the well-to-do, corporations paying less and less taxes, $2.4 trillion right now, corporations offshore so they will never, ever pay taxes. Taxes shift to working people and the middle class, and the poor rendered more and more socially abandoned and economically neglected with very limited options. And then the spiritual blackout that we see more and more, in which there's self-disrespect, self-destruction, self-violation, self-flagellation, especially among our young folk, especially among our precious young brothers. And in part because those young brothers who we see all the time in Rahway and other places, Bordentown and others, they tend to be the warriors, but they got the wrong venue and they got the wrong channel. They tend to be the courageous ones. They're the ones who willing to straighten up their backs. But the problem is that with lack of serious love and care, lack of education in decrepit school systems, with those school systems now being viciously attacked, privatized, with profiteers coming in, closing public schools, trying to make big money on public education, leaving more and more and more behind. You see, they have very little access to the sense of who they are as a people, the sense of their history. Their energy's high. Their vision is very, very narrow. Their courage is intense, but their love potion is low. And they're full of revenge. And they're full of a lot of hatred because they've been hated so. And that would be true for any peoples of any colors to have to deal with those circumstances, those conditions, and come out of a history of a people who have been wrestling with trying to love ourselves since the first African stepped off that slave ship in 1619. And that's one of the reasons why what? That when it comes to big money, we always find it when it comes to prisons and war. Comes to jobs with a living wage? No. Comes to education? No. Health care? No. But we got a budgetary crisis. Well, we notice that your budgetary crisis is secondary and tertiary when it comes to this carceral state, this new Jim Crow, this prison industrial complex. You come up with the money. You want to put them right in the community now. That's war priority. And you always find it for war. You see how quick Congress came up with billions of dollars to support Ukraine in the last few days? Wasn't that something? What about Detroit? Not a penny. Not a penny. Not a dime. Wall Street in trouble. Bad choices. Bad judgment. When poor people do that, they say, pull yourselves up by your own bootstrap. You got to be responsible. You're going to be dependent on this money we're giving you. Wall Street got $787 billion. That's corporate welfare. And for 3.5 years, it got $85 billion from the Federal Reserve with near zero interest rates, and yet let some of our working class students try to go to school and get a loan with interest rates. If they could get the same interest rates that bankers get, more of our precious children would be in school. Oh, this is how warped the situation is. But we view it as just business as usual. Oh, we need organizations that same. Based on the love. Now, you got to keep the love in it. And this is part of the problem, you see, is that so many everyday people, they've seen folk who emerge as these leaders and spokespersons, but it looks like they lukewarm on the inside. That's a problem. That's a problem. And I'm not talking about perfection. I'm not talking about purity. I'm just talking about trying to have integrity in a sense of decency and honesty, being self-critical, but most importantly, putting up front the love. Doesn't have to be in language. Most importantly, it's got to be in your deeds. It's got to be in your example. And it's got to be something that you feel. In an age of big money and big business and big banks, we're trying to tell the truth, expose the lies, and bear witness. And it's got to connect with every sphere and every sight in our lives. I used to tell my dear brother Mensa Louis Farrakhan, I love that brother very much. We wrestle with all kind of issues and so on. But I say, the nation, given all the commitment, without music being at the center of the ritual, it's hard for me to conceive of how it's going to ever be a mass movement, my brother. And he's an artist himself. He's a fine singer himself. But of course, Elijah Muhammad, who was Reverend Elijah Poole, he was a Black Baptist minister before he became a Muslim, He got so upset with all of the excessive emotionalism in black churches that became cathartic but didn't translate into struggle for justice. That when he founded his movement, he said, we ain't gonna have no music up in here. No, let the Baptists and the Pentecostals and some of the AMEZ and AME keep that music. Making all that noise, and as soon as they get out there, they still cowardly. They still scared. They still intimidated. I thought they had the spirit inside of them. And that's an interesting point, though, isn't it? If you've been niggerized and Jesus doesn't de-niggerize you, what Jesus are you connected to? Who you talking about? What kind of witness you bearing? You can sing all the songs you want, but if it stays just on the surface and doesn't get inside of you and you deny yourself and pick up your cross and follow that Jesus, then what are we talking about? That's what Elijah Muhammad was talking about. Went on to become a Muslim. But the music, fundamental for young people, to give them a connection so they can have a critical vision and analysis. That talks about the critique of capitalism, the critique of imperialism. Yes, and most importantly, a self-respect, a self-confidence. And there's no doubt in my mind that when the historian puts pen to paper, 150 years from now, they're going to say, lo and behold, there were a cloud of witnesses in Newark during the ice age of Reagan. And Clinton was the one, mandatory sentences. It was Clinton, of course, who signed the bill eliminating welfare. It was Clinton who deregulated markets and undercut Glass-Steagall. Oh, yes, it was Clinton. Playing his saxophone, black folk responding with a smile. But his policies were coming at us. But during that period, there was a People's Organization for Progress. That said, oh, y'all may think that somehow we're old school. But there's a spirit of an Amiri Baraka that we'll never forget. You don't have to agree with everything he was talking about, but the fire that he had still at work in pop, still organizing and mobilizing and on the move. Oh, yeah. I can't wait when his son is the mayor of the city. I can't wait. But that's part of a tradition that spills over. It's going to spill over into the electrical political process. But when it spills over, what does it mean? As soon as he wins, the permanent government going to be sitting there looking at him. Who is what? Corporate Newark. Corporate business Newark. Now that you won, Brother Baraka, we here forever, at least until the revolution comes. You're going to be here for a term or two. And what we're going to say, we understand, we're not naive. We know that there's structural constraints, but we're going to be there putting pressure, loving pressure, critical pressure, truth-telling pressure, witness-bearing pressure, so that he won't be alone as he presents his own policies, focusing on poor and working people. We want him to be the Harold Washington of the 21st century, and that is connected to pop, is connected to the organization, is connected to the leadership of Larry Ham, and we're going to be there with you. Thank you all so very much. Stay strong in what you're doing.
Dr. Cornell West at Bethany Baptist Church in Newark, New Jersey. Last year in Philadelphia, community and campus constituencies came together to demand that Temple University stop encroaching on the autonomy of the African American Studies Department. After a number of demonstrations, the Dean of Liberal Arts, Teresa Soufis, backed off her attempt to impose a white woman as interim chairman of African American Studies. Instead, Dr. Dr. Molefi Asante was named chairman, with the support of Dr. Anthony Monteiro, who had led the protests. However, only a few months later, Temple University effectively fired Dr. Monteiro, with the complicity of Molefi Asante. Community, student, and labor organizations are once again mobilizing. Dr. Monteiro spoke with us about the outpouring of support.
The community response has been something that I could not have expected and did not expect. The community is united in supporting me, in demanding that Dean Schufis's and Dr. Molefi Asante's decision to fire me be reversed. The community have united with the students at Temple. The students are having a walkout of class on next Wednesday and a rally, and it might end in some form of civil disobedience. The week after that, the community will march from North Philadelphia, from the neighborhood that I'm from, to Temple University, which will be a march for justice, not just for myself, but they will be demanding justice for the people who are having their communities and neighborhoods gentrified. They will be marching to support the workers at Temple who have not yet had a meeting with the president and whose contracts are coming up, and so on. So what I would say is what we're seeing in Philadelphia is something that looks to me like a coalition against the neoliberal policy of Temple as an institution and of the city government of Philadelphia, which has impoverished black and brown and white working people and has gentrified neighborhoods and changed them racially and demographically and in terms of their socioeconomic class character.
Yes, how is this movement making the connection between gentrification and its internal university policies, such as firing you?
The connection has become obvious to everyone. An injustice to the community has gone hand in hand with this injustice to me. This gentrification policy is connected to my firing because I have been deeply engaged with the community, and I have openly and in other ways done things that go against the grain of the gentrification policies of Temple, such as the Saturday Free School, where I opened up university classrooms to people from the community and from throughout Philadelphia. The other thing is that whenever I would give conferences and symposia and lectures, I would always make sure that people from the community, both near Temple and not so near to Temple, would be invited. I wanted the university to be open to the community. I wanted it to change its racial policies. And so that kind of made me a target. But at the same time, it garnered real support for me, much of which I was not all that aware of until this struggle began, but it garnered a lot of support for me from the community and from students who admire and agree with the type of pedagogy and the type of practice of both teaching in the classroom and uniting the classroom with the community. Students are very appreciative of that, and they see that as something to which they aspire themselves.
Molefi Asante must be feeling somewhat isolated these days. He was appointed as chairman of the department with your strong backing after a confrontation between the community and university authorities, which were trying to take away the autonomy of the Department of African American Studies. Then, only months later, Molefi Asante, in conjunction with Temple University administration, participated in arranging for you no longer to be part of the faculty. This man was a person of some note in African American studies. Well, what do you think this has done to his reputation?
You know, the question of his reputation is a very complicated question. His reputation is not just one thing. He would like people to believe that he has a stellar reputation in African-American studies. But in many, many circles of African-American studies, he's not taken seriously. Now, I think his actions with respect to my job has undermined whatever was left of a positive reputation for him. I think at this point, he is facing a real crisis of his reputation and what he considers his legacy. And I think this is even made worse by the fact that he has tried to justify what he has done to me on ideological grounds, that ideologically I am outside of the bounds of African-American studies, and especially African-American studies at Temple, arguing that I'm a radical, that I'm a Marxist, that I'm a socialist, and therefore I don't fit in to his view of African-American studies at Temple. And the dean, I think, in some ways echoing him, said recently that we don't need W.E.B. Du Bois studies at this time in African-American studies at Temple.
So we see a situation in which the black chairman of African-American studies is as much a red-baiter as the white officials at Temple University.
Maybe more so. I mean, what Malefe is literally saying is that we don't need a free, discursive environment in African-American studies at Temple. Either you agree with his narrow Afrocentrism or you don't fit in. Even if you are the person, as is the case with me, who was in the forefront of fighting for the autonomy and integrity of the department, even more than he did. And it was myself and others, but especially myself, who went out on the limb to fight the dean to prevent her choice becoming the chairperson of the department, and in so doing, creating the conditions for him to become the chairman. He wants to give the impression that, well, he's there and had always been there, when in fact he had not been in the chair of the department for about 10 or 12 years.
You've also gotten support from labor. Why does organized labor, black labor in Philadelphia, feel they have a stake in what's going on the campus today?
I think there are several things going on here. You know, I've been involved with labor in general, and black labor in particular, in Philadelphia, for about four decades. Henry Nicholas, the president of 1199C, the hospital workers, but also the union that organizes the secretarial staff at Temple, I've been involved with that union and helping it to organize ever since Henry came to Philadelphia in the 1970s. The Laborers District Council is, I sometimes consider it, my neighborhood union. Their headquarters are not far from my house, but also many of the leaders of that union and members of that union are from my neighborhood. We came up together, and they see me in some ways as a role model. And one of the presidents in the district council said that, well, you add a quality to our lives because you are from here, and for someone from here to rise to become a professor at Temple means a lot to our neighborhood. But then I've always stood with them. I've been on picket lines with the laborers local. In terms of the International Longshoremen's Association, well, for a good period of time, for over a year, I was a longshoreman. And my father was a longshoreman for about 40 years. And many friends of mine are still longshoremen, members of the union, former leaders of the union. In terms of AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, you know, I've been involved with them. We've been on picket lines together. We've been in social struggle together. So I've been very much involved in the labor movement. I've been involved in social issues that labor is interested in. And as it relates to Temple, I've stood with Temple's union demanding that the president meet with the unions and that all of the unions at Temple get their contract.
It's almost accepted wisdom that black students on campus are passive and all caught up in creating opportunities for themselves, that they've lost the sense of social responsibility. But that hasn't been what you've observed in recent months.
Not at all. In fact, the opposite. And, you know, black students and white students, and I often think of them as the children of Occupy and the children of Trayvon, uniting on issues of the 21st century struggle for social justice. You know, there are a lot of things that have radicalized the youth of this country. Many people are not aware of that. These students are far more radical, far more educated, far more ready to sacrifice and take risks for social justice than most people realize. In fact, I think if there is a future for radicalism in this country, that future in a lot of ways are on these college campuses. And that's what I'm experiencing. And it's overwhelming at times. I have to tell you, it is overwhelming to me to see them supporting me in the way that they do.
The Federal Communications Commission dealt at least a potential blow to the monopolists who have sucked every drop of social value out of American commercial television. The FCC ruled that TV stations that sell substantial portions of other TV stations' advertising are the real owners of the station and thus are violating rules against multiple ownerships in the same market. The practice of joint advertising has meant that many stations are little more than shells for getting around the rules against monopolization. The National Association of Black Journalists applauds the FCC action, since shared advertising agreements usually mean firing the whole newsroom of one of the stations. The Minority Media and Telecommunications Council supports the ruling, too, because the shared advertising game only helps the media giants eat up the smaller guys. One person who's not happy is Armstrong Williams, the black right-wing propagandist and hustler who calls himself a journalist. Williams owns two stations that are essentially extra channels for stations already owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, which is the largest operator of non-network affiliated stations in the country. Williams claims that black people in Flint, Michigan and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina will suffer if he loses his stations there, since he's known to provide broadcast content that reflects a minority perspective. Now that is a joke. Armstrong Williams, whose mentor was South Carolina's rabidly racist Senator Strom Thurmond, has never uttered or written a word that was relevant to the hopes and dreams of most black people. In political terms, Armstrong Williams most closely resembles the character played by Samuel L. Jackson in Django Unchained. But more importantly, there is nothing on his TV stations that distinguishes them from any other corporate money machine. In Myrtle Beach, it's a long day of Jerry Springer and People's Court and Friends reruns, with news at 10 provided by a network owned by CBS and Warner Brothers. In Michigan, his station is just another NBC affiliate, spewing the same bland corporate crap. The fact that the owner is black doesn't affect the station's broadcast schedules and program content one bit. It's still garbage of no socially redeeming value. Program-wise, it's not even black garbage. Black people have no reason to be concerned about the survival of television stations that do not substantially serve their interests. It is true that Armstrong Williams has as much right as any white person to get rich from poisoning the airwaves, but that does not mean that we have to help him. And in fact, the airwaves still technically belong to the people. The government is obligated by law to ensure that the broadcast spectrum is put to uses that best serve the public. That means programming that is accountable to the public, including black people. There was a time when the FCC at least pretended to take public input seriously. The very fact that two generations ago, the black public could challenge the licenses of stations that ignored, abused, or simply underserved them, created wondrous opportunities for intra-black communications, opportunities that have been wiped out by corporate consolidation. The FCC may well make an exception to its own joint advertising ruling on diversity grounds, and that would be a victory for Armstrong Williams. However, black people as a whole will have won nothing and lost a great deal.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nuoga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.